Greetings and welcome back to the CBMW podcast, your weekly download of cutting-edge complementarian commentary and one-stop shop for egalitarian opposition research. Thank you for listening. I'm joined by Colin Smothers, the executive director of CBMW. I am Jonathan Swan, the executive editor of Icon, a journal for biblical anthropology. Hey, we have a special guest today, Patrick Piccolo from the Alliance Defending Freedom. Patrick, welcome back, or welcome to the show.
Thanks, John. Hey, Colin, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me on the show today.
Great to have you, Pat.
So, Pat, not everybody who listens to our show maybe follows the work of ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. Could you just introduce us to what you all do, and then at the end, explain your role with the organization?
Absolutely. So Alliance Defending Freedom, we are the world's largest legal ministry that's committed to what we call generational wins, sanctity of life, religious liberty, God's design for marriage and family, parental rights, and free speech and free association. So we have a global footprint. We have an international arm. We're doing things all over the world. I have to say, there are so many days when I am surprised to figure out something else that we're doing. It's so easy to get kind of siloed in your own lane. And so we have just this amazing opportunities that the Lord has been opening for us around the United States, around the country. And we're most known for our court cases. We litigate a lot and do a lot of impact litigation. And we've been blessed to find ourselves at the U.S. Supreme Court a lot. That is not what I do. I always point out I'm not the cool guy that's on the news or that's in the courtroom. I'm a part of the Church and Ministry Alliance team. And so at ADF, we realize that we want to impact the law. We want to have just laws that create the conditions for human flourishing. But the law is a limited instrument. And if we're going to truly see human freedom growing and flourishing, then we need the church. The church is God's plan. The church is the one that the Lord has commissioned to go forth and spread his word. And so we realize that it would be foolish to try to do our work without the church. So the Church and Ministry Alliance is our desire and effort to come alongside the church, engage the church on those issues, and then also serve the church and support it in its mission. So we help the church. That's what I do on a daily basis, is working with churches, schools, various ministries, rescue missions, to help them create policies and work through legal infrastructure issues so they can be more equipped to proclaim the gospel and do the work that the Lord has given to them.
Well, Pat, we're really thankful for the work you guys have been doing. And we'd like to just have you outline some of the work you all have done in the past. You know, we've been 11 years now or so since the Supreme Court provided a new definition of marriage. Can you give us a little history of how you all have been involved in cases regarding marriage and even religious freedom and liberty?
Yeah. So the Obergefell case was in 2015. And that was obviously a watershed moment and an issue that ADF had been engaged in since the beginning. I mean, if you look up efforts to take a stand for God's design for marriage and family, you're going to see ADF at the forefront of that in the early 21st century here, in that kind of crucial decade and a half leading up to Obergefell. After Obergefell, I would say a lot of the efforts have shifted to just ensuring that Christians and Christian ministries retain the freedom to operate consistent with their belief about God's design for marriage. So a lot of the recent cases, or the cases in the past decade, have been focused on protecting and preserving the ability of a church to only celebrate, you know, weddings that are corresponding to its own beliefs about marriage, and to hire employees who are in substantial agreement with those beliefs and living accordingly. We actually just recently had a pretty significant case along those lines in the Ninth Circuit that I'm happy to talk about, that was protecting a Christian ministry's ability to hire people who agree with that belief and live according to that same belief on marriage.
Pat, one of the things that I am so thankful for in the ADF, I think I ran across your guys' ministry maybe about the same time around Obergefell, about, you know, a decade or so ago. And just when I heard about your organization, I realize that there are other Christians who are concerned with the same things that I'm concerned about, and they're doing something about it. So one of the metaphors I think about when I'm thinking about ADF, even related to, you know, the case that you just mentioned, or the cases that you're just mentioning on marriage and religious liberty, you know, the metaphor I think is about like the U.S. military special forces or special ops around the world. So many things are going on across the globe that we have no idea are happening right now. The average American citizen doesn't know about this particular threat, you know, on the other side of the globe, or this thing maybe right in our own backyard, but they are being addressed and dealt with. And then maybe you'll read about it 5 years later in some, you know, book or some, you know, big picture show. But I think with the ADF, that's the kind of work that you're engaged in all the time. In the courts, in the legal system, upstream even from when this stuff is thankfully hitting sort of average American life. So questions like, should a Christian organization be able to hire Christians to work for them? That's a question that your average American is just going to say, well, of course, yes. Why would it be any other way? But it's the ADF and organizations like yours that are having to go to places like the Ninth Circuit, make that case in legal doctrine and in legal arguments, and then winning those. So yeah, tell us about that recent win. But sort of in that frame where the ADF really is, they exist for Christians, for churches, and really carving out spaces for us to be able to just continue to live as we know the Lord has called us to live.
Yes. If you were to ask let me say a couple things. So first of all, Colin, to your metaphor about special ops, I work here and I feel that way. There's so many times when I wake up, I'm like, I can't believe that that's happening and that we're doing something about it. That's awesome.
Yeah.
And so it's that sentiment is shared even by people who work here, just because there's so many things going on. So that is a keen observation. I think that there's a lot of people who would intuit, oh yeah, obviously you can do that, or obviously that wouldn't be a problem to be able to do that. It's also true, and this equally shocks me sometimes, how many organizations that I'll work with that don't know that they can do that. Where I'll talk to a Christian ministry and they don't realize, oh yeah, I can actually ask in a job application, do you agree with our statement of faith? Do you share these same beliefs? And so there's just so much confusion that could actually reign around those issues, both for people who are in the ministry world and for the average American. So the case that you're just referring to is called Union Gospel Mission of Yakima. It was out in the Ninth Circuit. This is a rescue mission that has a beautiful purpose, just like every rescue mission I've worked with, where they really take Matthew 25 seriously. They see the opportunity to serve Christ in the least of these brethren, and they see the gospel and the Holy Spirit as animating and powering every single thing that they do. And that in serving the needs of the poor, what they're really doing is seeking an opportunity to not only serve physical needs, but to proclaim the name of Jesus Christ. That's how they understand themselves. And so obviously, it's going to be really crucial to them to say, we need to be a tight-knit Christian community. We need to be supporting each other in prayer. And whether you're an outward-facing position or an inward-facing position, we want you to be aligned with us so that the heart of our ministry can truly be Jesus Christ and the source of our activity can truly be the Holy Spirit. Unfortunately, the Washington law against discrimination years ago was, and so they're in Washington state, was interpreted to say, hey, unless you're a what's called ministerial role, you can't discriminate on any of these bases. So in other words, if you are charged with preaching, teaching, those types of positions, then sure, there's a First Amendment right to hire consistent with your belief. Our law doesn't apply to that. But if you're a non-ministerial role, then you're still subject to these same non-discrimination requirements. So we challenged that and we said, no, the First Amendment's broader than that. There's a doctrine called the ministerial exception that's more well known and says, hey, a church or religious organization can determine whoever they want to be their ministers, and the government simply can't intervene in that decision. But what about everybody else? Well, we were arguing, hey, the church autonomy doctrine which is part of which the ministerial exception is a part, is bigger than just ministers. It preserves the right of a Christian ministry, of a church, or really any religious organization to require that the people that are working for it share their faith, because that just quite frankly makes sense. But it's actually a disputed topic. There is law review articles you could find that are making arguments in cross-cutting directions. And there wasn't a ton of great case law that was, you know, unequivocally affirming that position. And then we just recently, maybe a month ago, got an opinion from a Ninth Circuit judge, which is a big deal, saying, yeah, no, the First Amendment church autonomy doctrine, it is broader than just ministers. And it goes, it's beautiful. The judge does a fantastic job of just working through the ministry's self-understanding and then concluding, hey, if this is how they understand themselves, part of their autonomy that's protected by the United States Constitution is the freedom to decide that it needs its employees to be aligned with its faith, including its beliefs on marriage and family and human sexuality. And so you can require, according to this court, any position, ministerial or non-ministerial, to align with your beliefs on marriage, family, the Trinity, the, you know, redemptive work of Christ as part of the hiring process.
Pat, from the cheap seats, it sounds like, again, this is layman talking, but that sounds like freedom of association. Like you should be free to be able to associate with those in business, in organization that, you know, align with your beliefs, your practices, and not to do so with people that don't.
It's a great observation, Colin. So there's another First Amendment right. The First Amendment's big, right? It has a lot of different aspects to it. One of them is the free exercise of religion. And that's what the church autonomy doctrine is kind of related to, where it says, hey, as a religious organization, you have some freedom to make internal governance decisions, to discipline, if you're a church, to discipline your members, do things like that. And the government shouldn't intervene. There's also free speech, and there's also freedom of association. And there's an intersection of those two called expressive association, where you have the freedom to associate with people for the purpose of expressing a message. It is actually complicated how expressive associational rights then relate to the employment context. And that's another argument that you see courts entertain and sometimes dismiss when they're evaluating situations like this. So the church autonomy doctrine protecting this right is very important for Christian ministries around the country. The expressive associational right, I would have a more robust vision like you're outlining, but I wouldn't say that that's where the case law is sitting at this point in time.
Pat, could you give us a broad overview of the legal principles that, or just maybe legislative actions that have made these situations possible where a church, you know, has to actually go through litigation to be able to hire people who sign their statement of faith, regardless of whether they're a minister. So like what's going on right now in the state of the law that's actually requiring the work of ADF?
So one of the things that every state has, that the federal government has, well, just about every state, are non-discrimination laws. And these non-discrimination laws will cover typically employment and also things like places of public accommodation. Think hotels, restaurants. But then people argue about, well, public accommodations, how broad is that? What else should that include? So if you cross a certain threshold in the federal government, if you have 15 employees, you're subject to the non-discrimination law. If you're in a state, it may just be you have one employee. You're subject to the non-discrimination law. And then these laws will describe a variety of statuses on which you cannot discriminate, including race, color, national ethnic origin. Those ones were a problem a long time ago. They don't tend to be as much of an issue today. But then you have sex, which the Supreme Court reinterpreted to mean sexual orientation and gender identity as well, in a case about 5 years ago. 6 years ago. And in some of these state statutes, those are explicitly called out. Religion is another one that tends to be identified as well. Oftentimes, these statutes will have a carve out. They'll say, well, if you're a religious organization, you can prefer people of the same religion. in your hiring practices. People argue about the scope of that. States like Washington interpret that differently. And then there was a question of, well, is that just a statutory right? Or is the statute reflecting a constitutional right? And so you have these statutes with gray areas around the edges that then, when clarity is gained, sometimes emerge as clearly problematic. That's what happened in Washington. Washington clearly said, no, you can't hire people who are of the same religion if it's not a ministerial role, especially if part of your religion is that you're going to require them to live consistent with your beliefs on marriage and sexuality, because that's going to implicate other statuses. And so when we have that kind of clarity, a place like of where the state is, a place like Union Gospel Mission of Yakima says, hey, we're about to hire a bunch of new people. And some of them are like IT guys, and some of them are doing these other operational things. We don't see them as ministerial under a constitutional definition, but we still need them to be a Christian. And that's where we come in and say, that's a problem. You need to be able to hire consistent with those beliefs, but you have this very clear opposition from the state, where the state said where its position is on its law, and then we come in and challenge it. Something similar is happening in Michigan. We have the Sacred Heart case, where a Catholic school is confronting a Michigan law that is similar in its non-discrimination provisions, which is basically saying to this Catholic school, hey, you can't hire Catholics to teach at your Catholic school, to run your Catholic school. And we're challenging that law as well in the Sixth Circuit.
You know, I think that the cases that we've described so far sort of, they fall under that religious liberty, hopper, where it's, Christians should be able to have the right to organize and believe and practice according to, you know, their deeply held faith, and other people can do, you know, whatever they want to do. But I think what, you know, to follow up on John's question, what we've seen over the last almost two decades is an all-out war against reality itself, against the creation order. And I would actually probably date this. Pat, you don't have to weigh in on whether this is true or not, but I would date this back to about the first term of the Obama administration, 2008. You see this sort of the screws being tightened, the heat being turned up, and then especially into the second term, where he runs on the platform of legalizing gay marriage. It's in that second term that gave us Obergefell. And it's right after Obergefell, you have kind of the LGB rights, the T gets tacked on. And then there's the full court press on transgenderism and gender identity. So not just, talking about what should Christians be able to do and what shouldn't Christians be able to do, but, metaphysical questions like what is a man? What is a woman? What is marriage? Some of the more famous cases that we're familiar with, I'm sure just kind of your average American, are people like Jack Phillips, Baronelle Studsman. You had the Little Sisters of the Poor on the abortion cases. I know ADF was, if not involved in all of those and in a lot of those, and a lot of it was just trying to shield Christians from being able from this all out sort of onslaught and attack on our way of life that, and really just the way of life that people have lived for 2000 years. But it seems to me, we went from Obergefell, gay marriage, transgenderism. It seems to me like the tide does is turning, perhaps, particularly around the transgender question, the gender identity question. I mean, headlines are dropping just this week. If this podcast goes out next week, just last week, on medical associations, whole medical fields saying we were wrong to do gender surgery on minors, and we're taking a step back from that. The AMA issuing similar guidelines regarding minors, but what we've seen is it's not as if the culture war has been won by conservatives all out or that they're just kind of raising the white flag. It's almost like the focus is moving to something else. So one of the fronts that I've seen kind of coming down the pike for a long time now is the front on parental rights. So it's the connection between biological parents and their offspring, and whether or not the state has some kind of vested right to be able to insert itself in between that relationship, whether regarding education, whether regarding things like gender identity, and to sever that relationship or greatly impede that relationship, and exercise some kind of authority over against the natural parental authority that is God given. So, Pat, can you talk about that? Like, what should Christians be on the lookout for, you know, now and in the future regarding where this sort of culture war front has continued to shift, and where's that next onslaught coming? It feels to me, like I said, in the parental rights space.
Yes. So a couple things. One, I messed up at the beginning, and you kind of helped me there. So the mission of ADF is absolutely to keep the doors open for the gospel. That's what we desire to do. We want to impact the law. But we also want to impact culture. We want to do so in a way that creates conditions for a more just society, for human flourishing. But really the root of that is keeping the doors open for the gospel. And so as you have these shifting political and cultural winds, religious liberty becomes so essential in order to ensure that Christians can still continue to be Christians, to ensure that people can still live and speak the truth. Because by living and speaking the truth, we can bear witness and save souls. And so you're absolutely right. That is so much a part of our DNA here at ADF and what we've been trying to do. It's really so much the heart of our mission. Parental rights is a space that I think is of the utmost importance right now. And there's a number of cases that, quite frankly, I think like shock the conscience when you hear about them. And we have a number of those. One of them is the Foote v. Ludlow case out of Massachusetts that's actually we're asking the Supreme Court to review. And what's happening in some of these cases is it's sometimes called secret social transition by schools. Basically, schools are secretly transitioning, if you will, a student's own identity without telling the parents. And they'll do this by starting to use preferred pronouns at the school, changing the student's name, and they'll do all of these things on official documentation without telling the parents. And then when the parents request the documentation, they change the forms back to actively conceal what they've been doing without parental consent. That's what's happening in these cases. And the parents will find out sometimes because a school administrator forgot to change the form back. And then suddenly they see my 13-year-old daughter's being referred to by this male name. What's going on here? Or a teacher will let them know or inadvertently let out this is how we're, what we're doing at the school. And this is deeply unsettling if you're a parent. So the question is, well, what right do parents have to tell a public school system to stop doing that? In some cases, these schools have an actual policy that they're following when they're doing this, saying that we can secretly transition a student, or they would say we can begin to identify the student consistent with their own sense of identity without telling the parents, right? These are policies that schools have. So we're challenging these across the country. The Foote case is one example of that. And I would say that if you are a parent and you have any concerns about this or you find out about it, please let us know. Please reach out to us. Please contact us. But that in some ways is just the tip of the iceberg. It really needs to be clear that parents, regardless of their religion, have the right to direct the upbringing of their children because this is just. Because this is actually the design and the order of creation that is intended, that is most appropriate to human life and human flourishing. So those cases are huge. There's something similar you can find in the foster care systems where Christian foster parents have had their licenses to foster revoked because they won't agree with the state's position on gender identity issues. They'll say, no, we have these sincerely held religious beliefs, and then the state will revoke their license. The Waddy v. Winters case is maybe one example to look up if you're curious. But yeah, there's no doubt the parental rights front is extremely important right now, and is something that we're pretty invested in.
Pat, are these arguments for parental rights in schools in these cases of secret transition, which is so subversive and treacherous, these schools are just asserting a right to do this? And is ADF and whoever else is litigating these cases on the side of parental rights, are we sort of having to forge new ground and assert maybe in a new legal way what everyone always believed was true, which is that no, parents should have the exclusive right on their child's, you know, gender identity, things like that?
In some ways. So there is a history of case law where courts have recognized that there's a fundamental right of parents to direct the upbringing of their children. But what does this mean once your student is in the public school system? How do those rights interact once you've made the decision? So there was a case a long time ago where the Supreme Court said, yes, parents have the fundamental right to direct the upbringing of their children, which includes choosing the school that they want to go to. So they don't have to go to public school. But then the question is, well, if you do choose public school, then what is left of your parental rights on the other side of that once you've made that choice? And that's territory that we're still continuing to forge. What exactly are parental rights in that context? There was a Supreme Court case last year called Mahmoud v. Taylor. It wasn't our case. I believe it was the Beckett Fund, who does fantastic work. And here you had a Montgomery County, Maryland, public school system that was working into its curriculum LGBTQ plus storyline books that students had to read. And you had a group of parents who were Muslim, Roman Catholic, Orthodox, a whole mix of things coming along saying, hey, that conflicts with our beliefs. We'd like to opt out our children. And the school system said no. And so that was challenged. And thankfully, the Supreme Court said, yeah, you actually have the right to direct their religious upbringing, which includes the right to opt your kids out of that curriculum content. That was actually a free exercise thing. That was really a free exercise decision. So that needs to be the case, not just for religious parents, but for all parents.
Absolutely.
You know, I think that one of the things we're going to continue to bump into in this case and all the cases that continue to present themselves, you know, they go back to questions of fundamental reality. You know, what is a human person? How has God designed us to operate in this world as male and female? And, you know, one of the questions that I'm going to continue to come back to, even regarding cases on parental rights, is rooting our thinking and our logic in God's revelation, God's revelation in scripture, God's revelation in nature. Because one of the tricky things, I was able to do a little bit of work for ADF regarding these questions around parental rights. One of the hard questions around parental rights is the parental right isn't absolute either, because you have some of these parents who they're using their parental rights to force or at least coerce a transition in their minor child. And so in what way do parental rights adhere to that? Or is there some kind of, you know, superseding or natural right that a child has to be able to get to adulthood with their reproductive capacities intact and not assaulted by hormones or surgeries or whatever that is? In other words, all of us are going to continue to have to wrestle with and give an answer for what is a human person, what are we made for, and what are the conditions that societies and governments and laws can aim for that produce human flourishing in line with that design, that revealed design. In other words, we're not going to get away from the metaphysical questions. We can continue to you know, assert constitutional rights. We can continue to make the arguments, that the great arguments that ADF makes in order to, like Pat said, prop the door open to be able to make these more concrete and fundamental arguments that hopefully, Lord willing, through the Spirit, win hearts and minds to the gospel and really to God's design for who we are as male and female. That's our heart here at the CBMW, and we hope that we will continue to partner with organizations like ADF. Pat, can you tell us, just in closing here, what are ways that churches and ministries, maybe we have some questions about this further. Maybe we're facing in our own communities threats to either religious liberty or our understanding of how we ought to be able to relate to our children or to our neighbors, et cetera. What are ways that we can, as churches and ministries, get in touch with ADF if we do have questions, or what kind of services are on offer from ADF?
Yes. So if you have a live issue, you can go to the Alliance Defending Freedom website and you can complete an intake form, and that'll get work its way through the right channels. So if you're a parent and you have a concern about something that we've talked about today, feel free to use that intake process. For churches and ministries, we have a program, as I mentioned earlier, this is what I do, called the Church and Ministry Alliance. It's a membership program. There's a small membership fee that gets you access to a whole bunch of different benefits. We do webinars, we have blogs, we do legal updates, we have legal guides and resources. And then you can also get individualized legal counsel and work with, we have a whole team of attorneys committed to serving churches and ministries. I cannot say enough, if you read any of these cases involving a church or ministry, so often they are reading the documents that the organization created to articulate its own self-understanding, to articulate who it is on paper. Showing up as a legal organization on paper is crucial to being able to maximize your access to the constitutional liberties that you have. We want to help. We want to help empower, embolden, and equip the church so that it can feel prepared to meet this moment with courage and with conviction, so that souls would be saved and that all might be free. We want to serve you. We want to come alongside you. And if you join our membership program, it gives us an opportunity to be equipped to do that, to provide that service. So I would look up the Alliance Defending Freedom Church and Ministry Alliance. You can learn more about the pricing and benefits. It's really, the pricing is really nominal. And we'd love to serve you through our program and just really come alongside you for the gospel.
Pat, thank you so much for being on the show and for all you are doing at ADF.
Yeah, thank you so much, Sean. Thanks, Colin, for having me. I really appreciate it.
To find out more about what we do at CBMW, visit cbmw.org.